And good morning, or good evening, or good afternoon, whatever the case may be, from the high deserts of New Mexico. Remember someone used to say that a lot? Well, we can say it in all veracity, the high deserts. North of Albuquerque, in the middle of literally nowhere, with a gorgeous New Mexican night. We're going to have a lot of fun tonight and actually learn some things, because we are incredibly fortunate to have as our guest Jim Goodall. Now, he's no relation to the guy that does, you know, Animal Planet or Wild Kingdom or whatever. That's another Jim Goodall. But the guy we got tonight, I mean, in the media biz, they talk about gets. You know, you get this guest, you get that guest, someone who's got big name and all this. We have a get tonight, and it's Jim Goodall. So before we get to that, though, let me give you some hot new news, because we do news at the top of the show every night. Right now, if you simulcast, if you simul-screen on your computer, I don't know whether you can do that on a smartphone, I never tried, but you want to call up NASA.com side-by-side on your computer screen, because you've got the other side of Midnight.com on one side and NASA.com on the other. There is a live telecast from 250 miles in space, the International Space Station, because they are moving, the Russians are moving their Soyuz 13 spacecraft from one docking port around to the other side of the space station, the other docking port, to make room for a second attempt tomorrow night at about this time. Of course, we won't be on the air because it's Monday night, but they're going to try to redock the Soyuz MS-14 spacecraft, which has been kind of lollygagging around about 100 meters out, waiting for the automatic docking system to be repaired. And I have a feeling the reason they're moving one of the spacecraft from one port to the other is because the Soyuz spacecraft that are manned are under manual control. This incoming spacecraft, a Soyuz, you know, MS-14, which has the full-size human-scale robot Fedor, that's an acronym, and I'm not going to try to remember what it stands for, but it's a full-scale human-sized robot that the Russians have built that they're sending to the space station for the next several months to test out whether robots really can help the crew do various things in the space station. AI is taking over. Remember our discussion last night? Are we in an AI simulation? Well, upstairs right now, the crew, which had to actually suit up and get into the Soyuz 13 and go through all the launch preparations over the last couple, 3 hours, they are supposed to, probably at about an hour ago, they supposed to have undocked or prepared to undock. I'm not quite sure where this is because we've been getting ready for this show. So if you want to call up NASA.com on one side of your screen, turn down the sound, because you don't need the sound, but the visual should be very spectacular as a kind of a backdrop to what we're going to be talking about with my guest tonight, Mr. James Goodall. And if you want to go to the other side of midnight.com and click on tonight's banner, which is about the, quote, invasion of Area 51, and that will take you to Jim's guest page, scroll down, and under Radio with Pictures, that first item is all about the description of the new plan that the Russians have for docking the Soyuz at the space station tomorrow night after a very unexpected abort a couple days ago, which they think now they pinpointed to a broken amplifier at one of these docking ports. So they're switching spacecraft to the other port, and they'll be able to hopefully tomorrow night bring in the robot in his own little Soyuz MS-14 spacecraft. No live crew members, just a robot. Wonder what he's thinking out there. Anyway, item number two. We're going to be talking tonight extensively about Area 51. There's been more misinformation and disinformation and non-information about this piece of government-owned real estate probably than any other piece of real estate on the planet. We have the guy with us tonight who can correct the misinformation, give you some remarkable behind-the-scenes first-person reporting as to what really goes on there, some of the really spectacular things. And then we're going to get into some of the more, shall we say, speculative things, like spacecraft associated with the secret space program. So item number two is a Time magazine article a few weeks ago, which described the idea, which first showed up on Twitter a few weeks ago in June. Now, Tim Saunders told me a couple nights ago that the real originator of the idea of storming Area 51 with thousands and thousands of people invading Area 51 to see if there are aliens there actually is the brainchild of Heather Wade, who you might remember is the gal who took over when Art Bell resigned unceremoniously a couple years ago. And of course, now he's gone. So she's by her lonesome broadcasting. I don't know her schedule, but apparently like a year or so ago, she was the first one, according to Tim, who's a reliable source, to come up with the idea. But there's a new guy. In fact, let me give you his name, because it's kind of important. I like to get attributions. His name is Matty Roberts, and apparently he says that his idea for the original event was entirely satirical, but it got over 2 million Facebook users going and another 1.5 million interested. So what he's done now, and what you want to do is you want to go back to Radio Pictures, scroll down to, skip three, go to four. This is the latest Time magazine article. This is published, three days ago, actually on the 15th. It says in the top line, instead of going through the Area 51 raid in September, it looks like the creator of the Storm Area 51 Facebook event plans to hold a party in a town, little town just outside, which of course is the well-known town of Rachel, Nevada. And they're going to party day and night for several days, apparently across the weekend of the 20th of this month, next month of September. Still August, yes. And the town is not happy. If you read that story, you'll see that the town consists of 98 people. Yes, you heard that right. 98 people, not 99, not 100, 98 people, located about 2 hours outside of Las Vegas, sits near the midpoint of Nevada on State Route 375, a.k.a. the extraterrestrial highway. And the planners of this event, which they're listing as Alien Stock, echoes of, 50 years ago, Woodstock, anyone? Anyway, read that whole story. It's kind of an up to date thingy. Now, one interesting wrinkle in all this is that our guest tonight, Jim Goodall, is going to be sitting there, maybe in Rachel, maybe just outside the gates of Area 51, with another friend of ours, George Knapp, who is a major television personality out of Las Vegas. And they're going to be doing live television and live internet streaming of whoever shows up. This could be interesting. And the good news is I don't think anybody's going to get shot because they're not going to storm the gates. I don't think they would have been shot anyway. I mean, that would be really, really bad for this administration. Oh, my God. I mean, if they're worried about Hong Kong and a Tiananmen Square, too, can you imagine if an American citizen was shot down by rent-a-cops outside of Area 51 to, quote, guard the security? Would not play well in the coming election. So I don't think that's going to take place, luckily. But I do think some very interesting things could take place, and we're going to talk with Jim about that as the morning and the evening progresses. One last item, item number five, and we're going to talk about this later on in the program because I've got some insights and new news. Again, the mainstream makes absolutely no effort to investigate anything deeper when stories come up about the president than it's another stupid idea. If you look at item number five, Trump suggests, as the headline, nuking hurricanes to stop them from hitting America. And of course, the entire report is, this is a crazy, dumb, idiotic, absolutely insane idea. Actually, It's not, as we will discuss sometime during the morning. In fact, if during the third hour, we're going to open the phone lines, of course, for your questions, your comments, your perceptions. If someone wants to ask me specifics in that third hour, because I don't want to take a lot of time away from Jim in the first 2 hours, ask me about why this is not a dumb idea, even though the mainstream physicists who've been looking at this since the 1950s have come to the conclusion that it's a dumb idea. The problem is they haven't looked at it from other physics perspectives. Oh, and one little tease, it also contains within it the seeds of why Elon Musk appears to have gone off the rails when he suggests nuking the polar regions of Mars. So we'll get to all that in the third hour. So someone give us a call. I will give out the numbers. In fact, let me do that now. You might want to write this down. In the third hour, you want to call us at 917-889-8802. 917-889-8802. And that will allow you to reach the program. And if you have something pithy to say, we will be here to listen. Okay, let me give you a little background on Jim Goodall. And this is directly from the horse's mouth. Can you call a guest a horse? Anyway, he says, I quote, "How does a kid that grew up in what was once a very large apricot orchard in the middle of what is now Silicon Valley become an authority on Area 51, the Blackbirds, that's the SR-71, and things that go bump in the night? Well, it's a simple three-part strategy. One, your dad came into your room, you're 5 years old, and says, I don't know what's coming, but we have to go see it. You go outside, and what is coming over the coast mountains? Not one, not two, but 24 Convair B-36s with all those multiple engines burning fuel at a ferocious rate and creating an extraordinary din. Two, you're now seven. Your best friend's dad is base commander at Moffett Field. You get locked in the cockpit of a Lockheed XF-104 that was in the big Hangar 1 after being tested in the NACA Ames wind tunnels, and you get locked in the cockpit because the SPS is needed to get you out. Three, you are TDY to Edwards Air Force Base a dozen or so years later. You're there to install and maintain ground-based telemetry for Cat-1 testing for three programs, two of which you know about. The other is still classified. It's March 10th, 1964, and you can see for the very first time a Lockheed Blackbird in full burner, and you are never the same. The kid was me, Jim Goodall." Jim, welcome to the other side. Jim, you're there.
Am I on the air? I'm not sure if I lost the signal or.
No, you're on the air and you're five by.
Oh, good. Because
that is a hell of a bio. I've got to say that is the most interesting bio I think I've read on the air in the several years I've been doing this. I mean, you got us on the edge of our seat. So where do you want to jump in?
Yeah, when I was told this evening that later I needed a short bio, my resume wasn't what you were looking for. We had out to dinner with friends and I had to cut it short. And I'm thinking on the way home, now what can I write? Just a few lines that sort of give me a foundation of where I'm coming from. Now this starts back in 1954. I think a very young 74. I rode a Harley until when I was 72, and I gave it to my best friend, and now I drive a Corvette. So I guess I like things to go fast.
Oh, what year Corvette? What year?
It's 2010 Grand Sport.
Okay.
And my license plate is SR-71.
Do you know when I fell in love with Corvettes? Watching
in 1953.
Watching Route 66.
Oh yes. Yes,
oh my God.
62 Corvette at the end.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. I
mean that,
that
idea of the open road and having a Corvette under you, and a limitless highway ahead of you, it just got me.
I drove my vet to Minnesota 2 years ago. And Route 54 from Tucumcari to Wichita, just a big straight line. I got behind about 40 semis, and I pulled out, and I just hammered it. And I let off. I was pushing 140, and it was still going strong. All the trucks were honking the horn, flashing their lights, and there's no place for a cop to hide. I mean, it's just, you know, the road goes off to infinity.
Wow.
So.
That reminds me of driving across the deserts in Nevada or here in New Mexico. I mean, the West is a perfect place to have a car like that.
I live in Arizona.
That's a good place,
so
too.
We're close. Yep.
So let's begin at the beginning. How did Jim Goodall, kid of 15, raised in an apricot orchard, become one of the world's leading authorities on the most secret place in America, if not the world?
Well, it's because the Air Force and the Department of Defense and the CIA said no. In 1968, I had been out of the Air Force for 2 years. I was fascinated with the Blackbird. I saw it firsthand before the public saw it. I was fascinated by the place that it was tested at. But I wrote Air Force, Lockheed, Department of Defense, and CIA, and I requested, and I was willing to pay the published price for an 8x10 glossy. I gave what I was looking for. Their official policy was not to cooperate.
Now, were you
were you
a published author at the time?
No. And I hated term papers. I hated to write. I hated to do anything that had anything to do with books.
Oh my God! Karma.
That's what's so ironic about me working on my 27th book.
I've had a tough time writing 3 or 4. I can't imagine 27.
My longtime friend, he's since passed away, Jeff Ethel. He pushed me to write a book. He embarrassed me to write a book. He said, anybody wants any information on the Blackbird, they come to the Smithsonian or the Air Force Museum. Dave Menard back in the time and Jeff would say, well, get hold of Jim Goodall. He knows more as much about it as anybody. And this one thing led to another. And my first book wasn't on the Blackbird. My first book I co-authored with Bill Sweetman on the F-117.
Oh.
And because of what I did on the F-117, I made the front page of the Wall Street Journal.
Not bad.
Twice I've been on the front page, and my picture was below the fold on the last time.
Mm.
But it is. I don't know. If the Air Force or Lockheed or the CIA or the Department of Defense would have given me what I requested in 1968, which wasn't classified then, I would have been satisfied. I wouldn't be that pain in the butt that spent most of my adult life in Minnesota or the Pacific Northwest, now Arizona. I wouldn't be that pain in the butt. Mm. I'd be, you know, just some guy who had 5 years in the service and got out, which I did. But I went back in the Air Guard 10 years later. I would have been happy. I wouldn't have. Area 51 would have been the farthest thing from my mind. And then again, maybe not. But they're the ones who screwed up. They're the reasons I am who I am, because of their official policy not to cooperate.
More karma.
Right. Oh, when I did the 117 book, I was shortly after it came out, I was activated for Desert Shield and Desert Storm. I go to the Pentagon, and my security clearance is flagged. And the security specialist at Guard Bureau said, well, we can't issue a permanent Pentagon pass until this flag is removed. So I called the guy Special Projects. He was, I won't say his name because he's still alive. And I don't want to get any hate mail from him.
That's kind.
He was deputy director. He was deputy director for program security. His first name was Pete. I called him up. I said, Pete, this is Jim Goodall. You're screwing with my clearance. Oh, no, I'm not. Yes, you are. Where you at? He said, 5D156. That's an old, that's the old address at there at the Pentagon. So I went up, I made an appointment to see him at 1 o'clock. I go out down this hallway, long hallway, and there's one door with no name, just the address, 5D156 above the door. I press the safety lock. Someone buzzes the door open. It's a young lady behind the counter. I'm in uniform. And I said, I'm Jim Goodall. I'm here to see Pete. And her mouth about hit the desk. So it'll be about 10 minutes. We sit down. And I have a parade of people coming through, and I can hear them.
Yeah, you're breaking up a bit, Jim.
So I spent 2 hours with Pete, and basically, you know, if he said when I got a copy of your F-117 manuscript, I wanted to put you on active duty and charge you with espionage. That was in the Air Guard, Minnesota Air Guard. So I threw an autographed copy of the book on the table. I said, Pete, there's exhibit one, charge me. Well, we can do that. I said, yeah, because you're full of baloney. So I sent the manuscript to you, and I sent it to Ben Roach. I said, if there's anything in there that you feel that I should remove.
Jim, did we lose you? Oh, my. This is going to be one of those nights, folks. I just want to warn you. I think we lost him.
You beat Jim Goodall. Thanks for calling. Sorry I missed your call. Please leave your name and number, and I will get back to you as soon as I can. You take care.
Oh, my.
At the tone, please record your message. When you've finished recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options.
Keith, I think we need to recycle the count, okay? Let's try dialing him again. Okay. This could happen several times. Now, we prep for this show because we had him there in Arizona in the desert sitting in the right chair in the right part of the room, so there's a good signal, and he's on. There you are.
Yeah, I apologize. I think they're listening.
Of course they're listening. Are you kidding? Two of the most dangerous people on the same phone call on the air in 190 countries. Of course they're listening. So you threw the book down on his desk, and you see, when I was your age, anyway, we won't get into that. Go ahead.
Yeah. So I said, charge me. It wouldn't be the best interest of the program. I said, Pete, says I sent you the manuscript. You did nothing with it. You could have come to a drill weekend when I was active. You could have given me a vanilla, bland, know nothing brief, classified brief on the 117, and I'd been screwed. But you're too stupid and arrogant to do something that makes sense. He's getting irritated, and we went round and round, and after 2 hours, I was tired. He was extremely. I got up, and Pete's kind of short. I looked him right in the face, and I said, and my nose is about 6 inches from him. I said, Pete, you know what drives you nuts about me? He said, what's that? I said, I'm not afraid of you. And I give him the raspberry. I go,
well, you know, you had him by the shorts because they document everything. All you'd have to do is to file an FOIA, and the paper trail of you sending in the manuscript for them to approve would pop out. It'd be there.
Yeah, well, they didn't do anything with it. They just ignored it. They figured I'd go away.
Really?
Yeah, they did absolutely nothing.
Oh, because you were a brand new author. They didn't have any calibration on you.
Well, yes and no, because before I wrote the book, my boss was at a general's staff. I was the wing historian, so I either worked for the one star or the two star.
Okay.
And that was my chain of command, Jim Goodall and the boss. General Broman was at a general's conference in D.C. It was a week-long thing. And John Vesey was chairman of who's also from Minnesota. So somewhere in within this conference, my name came up, and Jim Blumen timed it. I was a subject.
Ah, we're losing you again. You might want to shift position. Go ahead.
We're hearing every fifth word.
Oh, no.
I haven't moved my head.
Okay. Well, you might want to move just a little bit because I think we're on the fringes of some lobe or something, like side lobes.
Is position. Can hear me now?
Yeah, we can hear you now. No, now you went away.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, now we can hear you. You're going in and out. It's very weird.
I'm not.
No, you're really breaking up. We're not hearing anything. Yeah, they're having fun in games. I mean, the signal was crystal clear this afternoon. So
yeah, how is it now? Can you hear me?
Yeah, now we can hear you.
Okay, I just moved about 2 inches. General John Vesey told my boss. He said, "Those of us at Joint Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, we refer to yours. We given your Sergeant Goodall a name. We refer to him as Agent Orange." He said, "There's a number of our younger officers who would like to have him whacked, but the rest of us really enjoy what he does."
Ah, now this whole controversy was because you had published Inside the System before as an historian, but this was your first public book, right?
Correct.
That's where the trouble came in. That's the whole friction, because suddenly you would have a much bigger audience, and if you can write like you can talk, people would pay attention, and this was this super, super secret, deep, deep black program that no one was supposed to know about. And so, yeah, I can see why you ruffled feathers up and down the chain of command.
Well, I was aware of it in 1978 before it flew.
Hmm. When it was called Have Blue or something?
No, I didn't even know about Have Blue. But all I knew it was – it was an attack aircraft with an F designation. It was faceted, and it wasn't like anything you've ever seen before.
A flying geometry puzzle.
And it was like a blind man describing an elephant.
Oh.
All the pieces were there, but they were in the wrong order.
Okay. Tell you what, we're approaching the bottom of the hour here. So why don't we cause a pause? Your move seems to improve the reception, and
I really apologize for that.
No, it's not your fault.
It's
them. We can blame them tonight. Okay.
Yeah, it's them.
Okay.
Well, hold it there.
And yes, we are entertained tonight by someone who is absolutely fascinating to listen to. We're going to get a lot of backstory, a lot of stories that you have not heard about this mysterious area called Area 51. My guest tonight on the other side of midnight, James Goodall, author, historian, military aviation expert, and he knows a lot about this place called Area 51. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.
midnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcast that provides you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. The other side of midnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone, on this Sunday night, August 25th, to the other side of midnight. My guest this morning for the entire show, Jim Goodall, who is probably the world's only living real expert in the intricacies. Well, given how much opposition you've had to become expert. So I'll tell you what, let us pick it up. Now the F-117 was tested at Edwards. And that has an extraordinary storied history. When did you first trip over Area 51 and its mysteries and secrets?
Well, I've had the, I don't know if it's a curse or an honor, to be a longtime friend of John Lear.
Oh, I know John very well.
And those who don't know who John Lear is, I can't imagine they don't, but he's the son of William Lear, but he's also one of the foremost UFO guys out there. And because of John Lear, I met Bob Lazar.
Ah.
But the first time that, I mean, I've known about Area 51 since probably the early 70s. I got my first look at Area 51 with John Lear in 1987. We found a way to the top of Whitesides Mountain. And we spent a night up there. Next morning, we're up there getting ready to shoot the place, which I did. I shot a whole series and linked, put them all together as a panoramic. And apparently they got a glint off my telephoto because about 15 minutes later, I'm real hard of hearing. And John says, the Pave Hawk's coming. That's what he means. So we sort of sat behind a notch on the top of Whitesides. And these guys came right. They weren't more than 15 feet over the top, maybe 20 feet over the top of the mountain. And we're right at the peak. And there's some guy hanging out the door with, it looked like a 600 millimeter Nikon on strapped to him, something sticking out. And we just sort of sit there and waved at him like we were in the Rose Parade. And by then we knew that nothing was going to happen, so we came down off the mountain, and they harassed us when we got down there. And
okay,
if we were in public lands.
If people want to see this view, you go to theothersideofmidnight.com, you click on tonight's banner, the Area 51 banner for Sunday the 25th. That takes you to Jim's guest page. Scroll down and read it with pictures to Jim's items. Item number one is this spectacular, gorgeous panorama. You're following along on the computer. That is Area 51 beyond those mountains in the foreground, right?
Correct.
That's a spectacular view.
It was 17 degrees up there. The wind was blowing about 25 knots. I stayed the whole night. John Andrews stayed the whole night, and so did Glenn Campbell. Stu Brown and Tom Luttrell and Bob Gilliland, the first guy to fly the SR, joined us up there. And he walked, they all walked down off the mountain around midnight. So we spent the whole night up there. Boy, it was cold. It was cold.
Did you know it was going to be that interesting before you went up there? I mean, in terms of temperature-wise and all that?
I spent 27 years in Minnesota.
I was going to say, you probably were. Yeah.
I spent, a, I spent a lot of time out in the desert. I knew it was in good. I was ready for it. The other guy, Stu, wasn't, and neither was Tom.
Now, were
so
you surprised?
Down the mountain.
Were you surprised back then that there were these glaring security holes? Because from up there, with the really long lens or stabilized, gyro-stabilized, I mean, you can see a hell of a lot that you're not supposed to see.
From the top of Whitesides to the tower at Area 51 is 13 miles.
Okay.
That's not very far.
No.
And the advantage, it's to the east of the facility, and when the sun comes up, it's to your back.
Ah.
So you want to shoot in the morning. By the time the afternoon comes, the heat distortion makes, you know, photos
sure.
pretty much worthless. Then Glenn Campbell and I, along
with hang on. These days, if you took a webcam, and like astronomers, amateur astronomers are getting stunning, you know, sub 100-foot images of what's on the moon from the Earth through the atmosphere, you use
yeah.
a technique called image stacking. You can get with webcam, you do a streaming record, you get thousands of frames. The software picks the best frames, and you can probably see license plates in Area 51 with that kind of new technology.
It's amazing. It really is amazing. But then we found Freedom Ridge, and we were they still had unencrypted radios. The guards there at Area 51. And as we're driving up, we had marked the path to drive up to the top of Freedom Ridge by walking. And then we got a 4x4 and we went up, and there was three vehicles, and we could hear the guards on the unencrypted frequency. So my God, said they're almost to the top. Oh, jeez, this could be like a damn drive-in theater. What are we gonna do?
So when they scoped out this Area 51, they didn't figure that anybody would climb these mountains that were on BLM land.
Correct.
Why?
Correct. So for 8 years, we had unfettered, visible access to Area 51. But then they had, for the safety of the public, they took away 4,000 acres,
mm-hmm.
all of Whitesides and Freedom Ridge. So they took away our vantage points. But that's the price you pay. Now you just have to go do something else.
Well, this was an era where they weren't even admitting that the place existed.
They still don't. They really don't officially. They talk about it. They talk around it. A number of years ago, I think it was in the late 80s. I was in the early 90s. They came out with it was an announcement from the Pentagon about a dry lake bed in a test facility on Groom Dry Lake, and they spelled it all out. But it wasn't linked to anybody with a title. So I printed it out. I went to the base commander at Nellis and went to the secretary, and I said, can I get this copied onto the general's stationery and have him sign it? And they asked me to leave the building. they don't have any humor. I'm friends with those guys now, but yeah.
Okay. So the 3 hours is really going fast. So let's move along here. When was the first time you got on Area 51? And parenthetically, in the public press, particularly connected with Bob Lazar, who I think I've talked to a couple times, there's the confusion in the public mind between Area 51, an area called S4, the Groom Lake. I mean, how do we separate all these, and where does the cool stuff happen?
Okay, if you're looking at an aerial view of Area 51. And Area 51 is right next to Area 52 and just after Area 50. It got its name by the grid. I think there's section marks. And it goes from Area 1 to Area 205, and it was to track fallout from above ground nuclear detonations.
Mm-hmm.
And the name has just stuck. It could have been Area 52. It could have been Area 3, but it just happened to be Area 51.
Now, was this on U.S. Geological Survey maps or Bureau of Land Management maps?
There's no official publication that I've seen that from the government,
mm-hmm.
From the Air Force or DOD, that talks about, that mentions Area 51. I've heard them referred to as Watertown Strip. Most of them refer to it as the test site. I've had a lot of real high-powered people that I send out emails at Skunk Works, and they all get a big kick out of my email because it's Area 51, and that's how it started out. I'm on a first name basis, the new vice president, general manager there. He knows who I am. He has my black boot book. But all the guys at the Skunk Works all got a big kick out of my email, because they really, even today, they're encouraged not to say the name, because it gives it credence or validates the fact that, oh, Area 51 really is a place, and uh-huh. we really have been flying there since 1954 or 55.
They must be going through conniptions, as my grandmother would have said, over this latest social media thing, Facebook and Twitter. And
oh.
I mean, go ahead.
I have been to the fence line at Area 51, both the northern fence line and the eastern fence line, 50, 60 times in the last 40 years, 35 years. The signs say use of deadly force authorized. Now, nobody at Area 51, the Wackenhut security, the Air Force security, no one's going to cause could be an international incident.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Like,
you heard me at the top of the show compare it to Tiananmen Square. If in this latest thing, it would cause such a convulsion politically around the world that somebody, whoever did it, would get shot by their own folks. I mean, no way is anybody in danger. I mean, they're much more in danger from the conditions in that high desert, from running out of water you know, sunburn or whatever, or rattlesnakes, or, you know, not from the Wackenhut folks.
No. But what they will probably employ, if any idiots are stupid enough to try to run the base, they'll use non-lethal crowd control equipment, microwaves and sound.
Mm-hmm.
They'll lay you down instantly with turning the microwave on. All of a sudden you feel like you're on fire. It's not going to kill you, but it'll stop you in the tracks. And people say, well, they can't stop a million of us. Well, if for say someone decides to shoot somebody to stop it, and maybe there's a million coming, and it's, you know, they can't let them on the base, all you have to do is shoot the guy in front. Mm. Everybody else is going to turn around and hightail. They don't want to be number two.
But there's your incident. I mean, even using non-lethal force, if you have people rising on the ground with helicopters overhead shooting long telephoto lenses like out of Vegas or Los Angeles, it would be a political disaster for this administration.
For the military in general, too.
Yeah.
I mean, and the other thing is, if you get arrested, you're in for a wonderful 2 or 3, 4 days. If they arrest you and you're in a vehicle, your car is going to be impounded by the police in Pinoche, which is about 100 miles from Area 51. You're going to have to find a way to get, once they release you, to release you probably in Ash Springs or Alamo. You have to find a way to get from there to where your car is. It's going to cost you $500 to $1,000 for the towing fee. Plus, you're going to have court costs. It will be the worst week or 10 days of your life just trying to untangle what what was caused by you deciding, well, I'm going to drive into Area 51.
Well, that's
now,
why
John Lear and I have.
I'm kind of glad that the, you know, the organizers of this bizarre event have decided to make it a festival outside the gates and just have a mass of people showing up in the desert. So the worst thing we have to worry about is snake bites and, you know, sunburn and lack of water.
I've been in and around Tonopah Test Range, Area 51, over 80 times total. I spent a lot of time at Tonopah. I was the first guy to shoot the F-117, first quasi-civilian. I forget where I was going then.
Well, I'll tell you what, since we don't have a lot of time, let's move on. When was the first time you got on base and got up close and personal to a blackbird?
Yeah, it was about the 15th of March, 1964. I saw it on March 10th, but I was taking a shuttle flight to Hawthorne. I was a hitchhike down Laguna Beach to see my grandma. It was Easter week. And I came, I had a couple extra days off. And that following Monday, I came into the shop. I get a set of work orders, Lockheed hangar. And I walk into the Lockheed hangar, and I'm looking at the back of two Blackbirds, two YF-12 interceptors.
Mm-hmm.
Still there? Yeah. And I have never, I mean, it's affected me the rest of my life.
Hmm.
It was absolutely amazing because on March 10th, when we got into the shuttle planes, I saw them running. They had just shut down the engine. They said, hey, we're loading. So we're going to this Piaggio. It's a gull wing pusher prop thing. We took off over Rogers Dry Lake and we banked over so I could look down on the Blackbird. It was, the whole airplane was full. I think it was 12 people in there. And they were towing a C-130 right in front of it. They already shut it down. And I looked down and I saw a top view of this Blackbird, and I could not believe what I saw.
I mean, this was what, a couple of generations ahead of its time. So go back and pick up the story with the Lockheed Skunk Works. What is that for people that don't read history? You know, a lot of people now don't read history. And then how this amazing airplane came out of that aircraft shop.
Near the end of World War II, we were desperately in need of a jet aircraft to counter the ME-262 and the, I think it was a ME-163 Comet. That was a rocket-powered, the other one was a jet-powered. And two companies, Bell and Lockheed, vying for the first contract. They designed, built, and flew the XP-80 in less than 4 months, 4 to 5 months. It was a phenomenal time frame, and they did it in secret, and it became a little specialized shop where Kelly Johnson was the boss. He put together the finest craftsmen and engineers and maintenance people that worked for Lockheed, and he gave them full authority to get the job done. His door was always open. They developed the U-2 from signing the contract to first flight was 108 days.
Oh my God!
The U-2 is still flying today. When the Blackbird first flew on April 26, 1962, it had only been 15 years since Chuck Yeager had done Mach 1 in a rocket-powered airplane.
How many years? 15?
From signing a contract in September 1959 to first flight in April 1962. It's 32 months.
Okay, for folks that want to see what we're talking about, you want to go to theothersideofmidnight.com, click on tonight's banner with Area 51 prominently on it. That takes you to Jim's guest page. Scroll down under his items and click on number 2. That is a stunning photo of a Blackbird under, I guess, afterburner with the shock diamonds at the edge of space. And that's a real picture.
That's my picture. I took it.
How the hell did you get that?
No, I took it on the ground and in front of my phone.
Oh, you photoshopped it. Okay. Very
you did a good job.
Oh, you did a hell of a job. Yeah.
I worked on that particular airplane for 15 years. And the picture right below it, number three, says Dave Russell. That's who I had sent it to. That's me moving a Blackbird from Palmdale to Minnesota. I put it back together, and when it was done, it looked like my business card up above.
Hmm.
Yeah, there's no air-to-air shots of an A-12. That's an A-12. That's a CIA airplane.
Right.
There are no shots accessible to me or anybody else I know in the Blackbird community of any of the CIA A-12s with a giant shield markings. Those the red tail markings, the red numbers, which they change every flight just to confuse the Russians.
Hmm.
Yeah, I would love to say that that was an air-to-air shot, but it's my favorite airplane, so I had to have it on my car.
Well, tell everybody why it's such a special airplane, because again, I said it's probably two generations ahead of where we would have been if it hadn't been created. I mean, it's made of exotic things. When it's fueled and cool, it leaks onto the runway. I mean, it's bizarre.
The airplane, the skin is 30 thousandths, which is not very thick. The fuel cells go from about the cockpit all the way back to the tail. It holds about 10,000 gallons, U.S. gallons of fuel. And it burns that 10,000 gallons in, probably about an hour and a half.
Oh, my God.
But an hour and a half, you go about 3,100 miles. And the air, during combat operations at Kadena, during the war in Vietnam, the airplane they had loaded up with 100,000 pounds of fuel's maximum. They'd loaded up with 60,000 pounds of fuel. And it leaked so bad, it was like someone was on top of the airplane with two garden hoses going full blast. It would leak or consume 5,000 pounds of fuel, which is about 800 gallons of fuel before it took off.
Now tell everybody why. Because that make any sense for civilians. They have no idea what we're talking about. Tell them why.
Well, the environment is so extreme that a neoprene fuel cell like they have in most military aircraft today could not withstand going from minus 70 at 85,000 feet to 700 or 800 degrees Fahrenheit due to friction. It would get brittle or crack or whatever.
So those used engines drive this thing through the upper atmosphere so fast that the skin temperature actually is hovering around, 1,000, and the leak into the interior makes the fuel and the bladder that contains it up to around 700-800 degrees.
Yeah, what happens is they tried using a fuel bladder, but it would fail after two or three flights. So they went in and they used a water soluble gray clay. And I lived on Whidbey Island for a bunch of years, and it's an island of glacial remnants. You find this glacial, it's slimy, water can't penetrate.
Okay, we lost you again. There you are.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. It's immune to the heat and the cold, this gray clay. And that's what they use to seal it. And the airplane grows. I've heard people say, it grows a foot, it grows this. It grows. I sat down with Tori Larson, who was a metallurgist for the Skunk Works. And I asked Tori, how much does the SR-71 grow? From standard day to, after 21 minutes of flight, it's fully soaked as far as the heat. So he pulled out his little Bible of coefficient of expansion for metals,
mm-hmm.
goes down, does his calculation. An SR-71 grows in all dimensions, but it grows just under 2 inches in length.
Oh, my God.
And it seals everything up. Yet what is amazing is the engine. the Pratt & Whitney J58, which is a Navy-derived engine, by the way.
Right.
Not an Air Force-derived engine. It grows 2.5 inches in diameter and about 6 inches in length as it heats up. The whole air, everything about the airplane is phenomenal and had to be invented from scratch.
I was going to say, but to be invented in the 1960s is just, it's like magic.
That's what the Skunk Works can perform. They perform magic.
Hmm.
There's no other organization on the planet that can match the Lockheed Advanced Development Programs, also known as ADP, but in everybody knows it's the Skunk Works. It's the Lockheed Martin Skunk Works.
It's like everybody knows about Area 51 now by another name. Okay. Hey, right. Look, we only got about a couple of minutes before the break here at the top of the hour. Give people some statistics. What's it made of? How fast can it fly? How high can it fly? And how stable is she?
Well, there are three manned Blackbirds, the A-12, which is CIA, the YF-12 Interceptor, and the SR-71, which was operated by the Air Force. They all fly the same maximum top speed, pretty much Mach 3.24, which is about 2,100 miles an hour.
Oh, my God.
The A-12 is 4 to 5,000 pounds lighter than the SR-71. The SR-71, the highest one has ever flown, was during flight test. It was about 87,200 feet. Bill Park took an A-12 to 96,200 feet. 931, which the airplane that I acquired from the Minnesota Air Guard that I worked on, it flew at 92,500 feet straight and level. The fastest an SR-71 has ever flown, it was 974, which was Ichiban. It was the best flying and the last one to crash. During flight test, Bill Weaver took it to Mach 3.43, which is 2320, something like that, 2300 miles an hour. This is an airplane that was designed with slide rules. Harry Combs, who was one of the inlet specialists, Ben Rich told me, said he's our best inlet guy. He can visualize airflow. And I don't think he graduated from high school. He said he made it through the ninth grade when he had to drop out during the Depression.
God.
Yeah.
Wow.
You were hired at Lockheed not because you had credentials. You were hired at Skunk Works because you had abilities.
Okay, but hold it there. We're at the top of the hour. Sure. My guest this morning is Jim Goodall. He's describing this amazing science fiction-type aircraft that was built by the legendary Lockheed Skunk Works back in the 1960s, flying at thousands of miles per hour, crossing the continent in record-breaking time, in space, 96,000 feet. I mean, you're in space. And it was all done, as he just said, with slide rules. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.